the OTB Podcast Network.
OTB AM.
With Gillette, we don't just play the game, we change it. Gillette, made of what matters. That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.
Daniel Harris, good morning to you. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, good. The dust is settling slowly. What is your assessment of where Manchester United are right now?
They're in a pretty good place. They've got a lot of work to do still, so they shouldn't be clapping each other on the back particularly. But considering where they were after they lost to Burnley and where they are now, that is a lot of improvement. And ultimately, what you've seen is you've seen that Solskjaer, for whatever his faults may be and however much people doubted him, he came into a club that was absolutely on its arse and he's turned it around. And they are now a club that looks like it's going somewhere. If you were a player who United wanted to sign, you might look at it and think, I'd like to be part of that. And the question now is how much money the board give him and whether he's identified the correct areas in which to spend it and whether he picks the right players.
So much has come down to the signing of one individual that has transformed how everything, how the club is perceived. Now it looks like actually their scouting system really works, and it looks like they were building a platform. And it's not a fluke, because obviously this was a player that they identified, but it's wild the impact that one individual has had.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's kind of a strange one, really, because on the one hand, their scouts did identify him. On the other hand, they didn't buy him in the summer. And maybe the scouts did say, you must sign this man immediately, and no one did. But it doesn't massively smack of that. But yeah, it is true that Bruno's made a huge difference in that first you've got his ability on the pitch, which is immense. He sees the game in a way that other people don't, and he knows where to be, such that even when he's not playing particularly well, games tend not to pass him by, and that he will always contribute some kind of important moment or two. And that's what we saw yesterday. He played out his arse yesterday, but he was still involved in the goal that United scored. So United scored, and the penalty that he took also is significant, because I think that Rashford took a penalty United got against Bournemouth, and he stuck it in the corner, but the goalkeeper nearly saved it and wasn't far off saving it. Whereas with Bruno, I think he's 6-0 from penalties won, and the keepers are getting absolutely nowhere near them. And when you get 17 penalties a game like United do, having someone that you know will score them is important. But I think it is also important to say that United have been good in periods this season before Bruno turned up. They were good at the beginning, and then Pogba got injured, and then Martial got injured, and they were fighting it from then. So although he has turned up, and I talked about his ability before, but his mentality is also important, that he's not hoping things are going to happen. He intends for things to happen, and he intends to make them happen, and he doesn't let his teammates off. And I think that kind of leadership, both by example and by cajoling, is also really important in a side that for most of the last few seasons has lacked a bit of on-pitch leadership. And in England and in British football, I think, we tend to think of on-pitch leadership as people that scream and shout. But in any sport, and even in cricket and American football, where the captain actually has a lot of big decisions to make, the most important aspect of leadership is leading from the front. You've got to do your own job. And if you have a lot of players that are playing well, even if they're not the kind of people that are screaming and shouting, that still constitutes leadership. And that is the most important element of leadership. And Bruno Fernandes certainly has that. But United were looking good when they had all their players available, even before they signed him. But him signing unlocked lots more potential that was in that team. And yet it is unusual where you buy a player and they turn up and immediately they revolutionise everything that you thought your team was capable of doing, but he has managed that.
John Giles calls that moral courage, and you can see it when it's like it's difficult to get on the ball, but he still gets on it anyway, and he controls it, and he's happy to be taking that risk and to be taking that responsibility on, and that has had a kind of knock-on impact. One other thing in all this, I think, that is really important is that the previous couple of managers were not going to be there for a long time. They weren't there trying to build a 10-year career there. Van Gaal was there for a short fixed period and kind of knew that Mourinho more than likely was coming at some point. With Solskjaer, this is actually, he is trying to put long-term strategies in place. So I guess the impact of this is that if somebody comes in and says, oh, my client wants to be the best paid player in the world, Solskjaer's going to say no. Whereas the previous managers were like, well, I don't really care because I'm not going to be here to see the end of that contract. I just want to keep this player happy. I can't see them, for example, giving Alexis the contract that they gave under the previous regimes. I can't see them giving De Gea that contract under Solskjaer. I might be wrong about this, and maybe they're about to give Pogba the biggest contract and it'll be a giant albatross around their neck if he doesn't play up to it. But it just feels like you now have somebody who is trying to take ownership of decisions that are going to have a long-term impact.
Yeah, I think that what you've got is Andy Mitten did a brilliant interview with Solskjaer for United We Stand, and one of the greatest line, the best line he in that interview was, I'd rather have a hole than an arsehole. And one of the things that unites all the people he signed in one way or another is mentality. And he's not just signing people who he thinks are good at football. He's signing people that he thinks are the right kind of person to have around. And I'm sure that's why he pushed the boat out for Harry Maguire. I would be amazed if he thinks that Harry Maguire is as good a defender as the best defenders that he played with, because he isn't. But what Harry Maguire brings, in Solskjaer's opinion, is some presence, some leadership, some calmness, some authority, some dedication. And those were things that were missing in the team, and those were the things that he wanted in the team. And although it took him a while to make Harry Maguire captain, I would be pretty sure that when he bought Harry Maguire, he knew that Harry Maguire was going to be his captain at whatever time it became possible for him to make him the captain politically without pissing off too many people. And I think what you say is right. The other thing about Ole is that although people take the piss at him for being a Fergie tribute act and for playing all the old United tunes and for the whole his whole obsession with United's relentless self-mythologizing, when you're trying to create a culture, that kind of thing actually matters. And what you're seeing with Ole is that he, because he believes in all that stuff about the club that is very easy to laugh at, it means that he believes in the club. So the decisions that he makes, in his opinion, are for the good of the club. And Van Gaal and Mourinho is more the case, and this isn't particularly a criticism because they're workers and they've got bosses, so the decisions they made were more for the benefit of themselves. Whereas Ole is making decisions that even if the decisions that he puts in place don't benefit him because he's lost his job by then, they're decisions that will benefit the club. And he has changed the way that people around the club feel. If you remember what United were like towards, not just in the dog days of Mourinho, but for quite some time before that when he was trying to get himself fired and going through his repertoire of tricks to force that to happen, no one looked like they were enjoying themselves when they were playing for United. And you're playing for Man United. Like, those should be the times of your life. And I think Ole has changed that for the players. And he's bringing through young players. If you're good enough, you will get to play. And with Mourinho, that wasn't so much the case. One of the games that always sticks in my mind is they played Brighton away at the end of the season and they played out their asses. They lost. And in his interview afterwards, Mourinho couldn't hide his delight at how rubbish Rashford and Martial had been. And he was saying, you told me I had to play these two guys, I had to play them together. And look, I was right. And what Ole's doing is he's forcing performances out of some less good players, but increasingly he's getting brilliant performances out of his best young talents. And those were the kind of things that didn't really happen under Mourinho. Mourinho tried to get Martial out of the club to sign Ivan Perisic. And what Ole did, and I admit myself, I would have thought I'd had enough of Martial last summer. I'd had enough of the lack of effort. I'd had enough of him standing about waiting for someone to pass him the ball while he was standing still, for him not chasing into the box from the left wing. And what Ole has done is he has turned that guy around. And I don't want to say that everything that we see with Anthony Martial now is because of Ole, because I want to discount the work that the players put in. He must have put in a lot of work. But what he's done is to stop him from indulging his worst habits, he's stuck him in the middle of the pitch. And it looks a lot like he's taught him how to play centre forward now. And he has mentioned it himself, like we've done a lot of work with him in a way that I don't feel he's done very much work with Bruno Fernandes, because with Bruno Fernandes, they bought the finished article in terms of ability, in terms of mentality. But Martial needed some work and he needed some love and he needed some tough love. And Mourinho just wanted to boot him out of the club. And Solskjaer said, no, like this guy has a lot of ability and he's coached him and helped him and advised him and inspired him to get the best out of that ability. And I think Martial is probably the most obvious indicator of the difference between a manager like Van Gaal, who was more interested in coaching, but ultimately didn't seem to improve very many of the players, and Mourinho, who just had the ones he liked, had the ones he victimised, and seemed to find it really difficult not only to extract good performances from them, but to give them any credit when they did perform well. Like even when Luke Shaw had a good game, Mourinho said, well, that was actually because of me.
Yeah.
And Solskjaer has turned that around to be what goes on at United is not because of him or even because of the players, it's all about the club. And we see with Jurgen Klopp at Liverpool, if Jurgen Klopp has really good players at Liverpool, of course he does, but think about how many of those players that Jurgen Klopp has were brilliant players till they encountered Jurgen Klopp. The answer is maybe one or two. Mane was a good player. Salah was a good player. Wasn't a brilliant player. He's a brilliant player now. And that is because of Jurgen Klopp. And if you gave Guardiola's players to Jurgen Klopp, he would probably win the league. If you gave Pochettino's Tottenham players to Jurgen Klopp, he'd have probably won the league with them. If you gave any other manager Jurgen Klopp's players, I don't think Liverpool would probably be champions now. And one of the reasons is because Jurgen Klopp has created something there. It's not just his brilliant tactics or whatever and strategies. It's the way that he brings people in the club together, the players, the staff, the supporters. And that's when you get something that lasts and you get repeated winning. And it looks like that is something that Ole's trying to craft. And he might not be good enough to achieve it because ultimately in the next couple of years, in order to win any of the big pots, he's going to have to be better than Klopp and Guardiola. And that is a big ask. And not being as good as them is not a very good insult because those two blokes are brilliant. But Solskjaer is heading down the kind of track where you make people feel happy coming to work and you create an actual club rather than a team. And that was something that neither of the other two managers threatened to do or even really showed the remotest interest in doing.
Who is the next Anthony Martial, in your opinion, Daniel, a.k.a. the next player that is a bit of a sleeper in this Manchester United squad, whose mentality needs another tweak and they can go to the next level under Solskjaer?
Well, the two players I used to think and say were players who looked like they'd got to where they'd got to mainly on talent were Martial and Luke Shaw. Luke Shaw still has a lot of work to do, but it was noticeable when he was injured that I found myself saying, United are really missing Luke Shaw here, which weren't words that anyone ever expected to say. And in the last couple of months, particularly, but also before the break, he was forming a really interesting triangle down the left with Rashford and Martial. And he's going to need to keep doing that, and he's going to need to improve, and he's going to need to... And he had, just before he got injured, he'd started actually creating chances by himself. Like there was a couple of open nets, more or less, that were missed against maybe Palace, that were created by him. And he's going to need to start doing that and start doing more of that, because when you're looking to strengthen, left-back is one of the positions you'd be looking at. But the fact that he's left-footed is good because Brandon Williams isn't left-footed, and you can see the difference in the balance, although Williams played well, I thought, yesterday. But they, you know, I'd also have another fullback coming through called Ethan Laird, who is mainly a right back, but he is, I would imagine, he's going to be forcing his way into the first team by the end of next season because he's extremely talented. So Luke Shaw would be the one who I think has a bit more to give, but he's also going to have to find more to give because if he doesn't, his place is going to be under threat.
It certainly has been a transformative season in terms of how we think of Solskjaer, and he's had enough time now to build and say, this is discernibly my culture. As a result, he's now there for the long term, kind of irrespective of what the start of next season is like. Is that what we're saying? That we've reached a point where we know who the Manchester United manager is for the next couple of seasons at least?
No. I don't think it would ever be like that until you start winning stuff. Maybe you win the UEFA Cup, but even then, like if United are 12th at the end of next season, he's going to get fired. And it doesn't matter what he's done this season, I would expect. Like you can only, as Roy Keane said, the only thing that goes with the flow is a dead fish. And you can't afford to stand still. So however much money he gets to invest, and I don't know if it'll be that much, he's going to have a better team next season than he had this season. And that being the case, the expectations increase. And this season, top four was something that you would hope for because you looked at where United finished last season and you looked at the players he was allowed to sign and thought, well, actually, that's not really enough to guarantee top four. You've got a chance to top four, but you wouldn't say if you don't make top four that that would be a disgrace because the players you've got aren't that good. But now we know that the players that he's got right now are more than good enough for top four. They're good enough for third. And actually, if he'd have had Fernandes all season, and if he'd have had his players, his Pogba and Martial, fit for more of the season, he'd been talking about getting close to second. And United are going to strengthen, so in order to keep your job, you've got to keep improving and get closer. And whether they're good enough to sustain a title challenge next season is going to depend partially on how much money he's allowed and how much money and whether he spends it well. But it's also going to depend on what he can get out of the players. And if he doesn't get enough out of the players, then he will be out of a job. But he's more deeply ensconced than he has been at any point since he got the job.
How many players does he need to close the gap to sustain a title challenge?
I would say if he could get... if you could get two players, if everything went right and he didn't have injuries, then he'd have a chance. But I'd still expect them to tire because the strength of the squad isn't enough. But I personally, I would say the two most obvious areas of the team that need strengthening are centre-back, although Victor Lindelof played really well yesterday. He is not the standard of a United centre-back, but you have these players when you're building in this way. And you see it with Klopp at Liverpool as well. There were players who were not rubbish, who he replaced because they weren't good enough for what he wanted to do. And Lindelof, I would say, is one of those players. He's capable of being good, so he's not someone you'd say, this guy's absolute nonsense, bin him. But a better centre-back than Lindelof is necessary. And that would be the first place I would probably go with, either would be a centre-back, or I'd go for an upgrade on Matic. Increasingly, I'm thinking that would be my first port of call, the midfield player.
Interesting how you haven't mentioned the goalkeeper.
I guess the way I look at that is that United and De Gea are stuck with each other. I can't see any way that they could shift him and his salary. So it's ultimately, we know that he is good at goalkeeping. It's a mental thing. And they have to find a way, you know, between them of making that better. I wouldn't go and bust half of my budget for the summer on a goalkeeper when I had De Gea. I would hope that we could sort the De Gea problem out. And if not, then we'd have to go with Romero until next summer, because I just think that there are other areas of the team where you don't have someone who's potentially someone who could be more than good enough. The thing with De Gea that's odd is that the areas in which he's always needed to improve, he's never improved. Like, he doesn't come for crosses and he doesn't kick well. And those are the things you could work on and become good at. I mean, yeah. I know it's quite easily in this. I mean, I know I'm not saying easy and like, I could do it. But if you're someone like him, those are things you should be able to improve. But no, I wouldn't go for a goalkeeper. I'd go for a replacement for Matic. Increasingly, watching United over the last few weeks, that would be my priority, because it's become clear, I think, to teams that play United, if you press Matic and the defenders, then they struggle to get the ball out because basically it's only Pogba who's a reliable passer, except Pogba's not always a reliable passer because he takes risks in areas that he shouldn't. So I would say you want a replacement for Matic. That would be the first thing that I would do. Then the best centre-back that you could possibly find, and obviously it looks like they're going to buy Jadon Sancho. Now, I've seen Jadon Sancho play a fair few times. I've never seen him play and thought this is a brilliant player. But enough people that have seen him much more than me say that if you get the opportunity to sign him, then you just have to do it. So I guess I'm prepared to accept that. And United do need a right winger. And also what we saw in the last few weeks of the season was that there was no alternatives outside the front three. So another player is essential. And someone that you can bring in to make sure that you can rest players. So what I think will happen, the first choices will be Jadon Sancho and a centre-back. I'm not even sure they want to buy a midfield player at this point, but if they can then raise enough money from sales, they'll get the chance to buy another player of some sort. But that's what I would expect to happen.
Is Declan Rice the actual perfect player, because he can play either in midfield or as a centre-back, and he could have a really good Manchester United career with either of those positions, but while he is still developing as a player, you can play him in both. So Lindelof can come in and out of the team if he needs to be rested. Matic can come in and out of the team if he needs to be rested. Matic is still, they've obviously signed him to a new deal, so he's the type of player who will play 25 to 30 games next season. And let's face it, they're going to be playing 65 games next year, a lot of them at very high intensity, where you're going to need a lot of bodies.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think with Rice, he's someone who seems to have improved quite a lot recently. I don't know. I think that if you sign someone like that, you say this is your position and you play them there. But if he's going to be a centre-back, then centre-backs generally tend to develop more slowly than strikers, because strikers are much more about instinct and improvisation. Whereas to play centre-back, you need to think about your game quite a lot. You need to think about what the opponent's going to do, and it's something that you learn. Even however natural the defender that you are, most strikers more or less like are as good as they're going to be when they're 23, 24. They might stay that good for quite a long time, but they're learning the game still, but ultimately they're much closer to their ceiling at that point. Whereas if you sign someone like Declan Rice and you're moving him to play centre-back from midfield, number one, you want him to learn that position. And number two, you want him to build a partnership with whoever he's going to play. So I wouldn't want to sign someone like that, like Declan Rice, and say, well, we'll play you sometimes here and a bit there. It would be more, this is what you are. And in an emergency, then they might play him somewhere else. But also as a midfield player, when you're playing someone in front of the back four, particularly when the other two midfielders are Pogba and Fernandes, then learning positioning and learning when to pass the ball, because more or less you're learning how to control the pace of the game. And again, there are very few players in their teens or early 20s that are good enough to do that. I mean, there are very few players who are 27, 28 who are good enough to control the game. And if you're getting someone in and intending them to do that, then you just want them to settle in. You don't want them to be thinking about what position they're going to be playing next week. You want them to learn the position and to play the position. Earlier on in the season, and last season, when I saw Declan Rice play, he looked a bit like a centre-back playing in midfield. Mm. But over the last few weeks, he's actually looked much more like a midfield player. I thought he played really well against United the other day, and his passing's improving, and we can see that he can shoot from distance as well. Again, I'd need to see more of him because his short game needs to be good. I would say to play that position, the main thing that you need to be able to do is you need to be able to pass the ball forward quickly and ideally off both feet. And you need to also be able to do that under pressure. And that's why Sergio Busquets was the greatest player at playing that position, because he could do those things. He could find the yard and he could pass the ball forward quickly. Paul Scholes could do it as well. And if you play someone like Rice there, who's not a runner, because City do it a different way. City play two attacking midfield players usually, and then they have Fernandinho sort of covering a third of the pitch almost, extends from the centre circle backwards. And City tend to do it more with legs than with passing. So you need to decide what kind of player you want. If you're signing Declan Rice, I don't think he's someone who's going to cover as much distance. So what he would need to do would be need to control the game, control the tempo of the game with the passing, and make sure that if another team was pressing, you don't necessarily need to get the ball wide or long to get around it, but you have someone who can pick clever 5, 10, 15-yard passes to get things moving. And that's the kind of player that United would need. And I'm not certain that Declan Rice could do it, but I certainly think it's more possible than I did 4 months ago.
So you wouldn't be disappointed if he signs, but you're not entirely convinced that it's going to be an automatic straightaway success.
It's not that I'm not convinced, it's that I would feel that I don't feel I have seen enough 90 minutes of Declan Rice to say, yeah, this is definitely the case. What I would say is that my friend, colleague at The Guardian, Jacob Steinberg, has seen a lot of Declan Rice, and he thinks Declan Rice is a really, really good player. But he's seen a lot more of West Ham, so I guess although I give the impression of having a lot of opinions, I try and restrict them to things I actually feel like I've got the right to have an opinion about, and Declan Rice isn't one of those things. So I think that I like what I've seen over the last kind of 4 or 5 months, but if I wanted to know about Declan Rice, I would definitely ask someone that's seen more of Declan Rice than I have.
All in all, it's been a very positive season from Manchester United's perspective, given how low they were at the end of the Mourinho era. Is that a fair wrap summation of where we are at the moment?
Yeah, for sure. It was difficult at times. What's been good for United about this season is even in the dog days of Pereira in midfield, they managed to find performances in the big games. If you look at the top of the table, Liverpool, they lost to you twice, but they were within a few minutes of beating them at Old Trafford. And actually, if they'd have had Bruno Fernandes, then they might have got something at Anfield as well. They've beaten Chelsea 3 times out of 4. They've beaten City 3 out of 4. And they've beaten Leicester twice. And they've got a win in the draw against Tottenham and a win in the draw against Sheffield United. So that is good. That's better than good, actually. That's excellent. And what they started to do is they started to beat the teams that they should have beat, so they should always be beating, and they've actually started to do it in style. There was a drop-off towards the end of the season when they got knackered, but you can see that they've reached a point now where their bottom level is increasing and their top level is increasing, and they now need some tweaks to elevate both of them. They need to fill the holes in the team, and they need to strengthen the squad a bit too. But ultimately, if someone had offered you third place, quarterfinals of the UEFA, then you would say, yeah, that is all right. And they also got to the semi-finals of the other two cups. They were close against City. And again, if they'd signed Bruno Fernandes in time to play City in the first game, that might have, at home in the League Cup, that might have made a difference. And they were still quite close. So, it hasn't been overwhelmingly positive, because there was a lot of negativity in the first part of the season, and rightly so. But as soon as they got all the players fit, they look like a team.
Yeah.
And it's a long time since we've been able to say that.
Well, Daniel, great stuff. Enjoy what remains of the off-season. Obviously, there's plenty of European football to look forward to as well. So we'll obviously talk to you very soon. In the meantime...
All right, have a good day.
Cheers.
You're watching OTBAM. It's live in association with Gillette. Good mornings. Start with Gillette, giving you the confidence to tackle the day ahead. We are turning our attention back to the Premier League, and specifically on Aston Villa and their great escape yesterday. Delighted to say that Ray Houghton is with us. How are you, Ray?
Yeah, very good, thanks. Yeah, very good indeed.
A great escape indeed for Aston Villa. How unlikely was this, in your view, 4 or 5 weeks back?
Well, four games ago, they looked like they were doomed. But then they got the two wins and two draws in the last four matches, 8 points. It was absolutely massive. And, you know, they had to dig it out yesterday against a West Ham side who've been in very good form. Watford, you know, the results in the last couple of games have been pretty poor. And then you had Bournemouth going to Everton and getting a fantastic win, which put pressure on Villa. But they've done enough to get over the line. And I'm sure Dean Smith and all the players and everyone associated with Villa are delighted to be a Premier League club for next season.
What's the main reason, in your opinion, that they did turn it around over those last four games?
Well, I think a little bit of confidence, a little bit of belief. Obviously, the players were getting fitter the more games that they were playing. I think early on, in all the games that I watched, you could tell that the pace of the game was quite slow. But the more they were training, the more games they were playing, they were actually getting better and better. And I think with Villa, if they defend well, and that's always something that was levelled against them, if they defend well, it gives them a platform to, you know, get some goals. And that's what they've done. If you looked at the results recently, they haven't conceded as many goals as they'd done previously. And that was a very important point. And Jack Grealish, we don't know if that's going to be his last game for the club or not. But he's a Villa fan. He's been around the club for a number of years, and he'll be delighted that he's helped to keep them safe.
What's your take on that? How likely is it that Jack Grealish is a Villa player come next season?
Well, I mean, the point with this is, you know, what's your ambition as a player? You know, and it depends who, you know, is going to pay the money for him. Because I would imagine, at the moment, with his age and the way that he's really responded to the Premier League. I mean, that was a question mark, wasn't it? How would he do in the Premier League? And he's done exceptionally well. He's been Villa's best player. He's been the player that they've gone to when they've been struggling. He's come up with so many important goals. And it would just be dependent upon who comes in for him. But, yeah, you know, if he wants to go and make a better career for himself, then he might have to move on from Aston Villa. Although Villa have got money. You know, I have heard this. Mm-hmm. Aston Villa have got a good owner who's very willing to put money into the club. So it might be dependent on their recruitment policy as well. And if they can bring in the right personnel, it might just tempt him to stay for another year just to see where the club is going. Because if you can get success with your homegrown club and the club that you've supported as a youngster, there's no better joy than that. So it will be dependent on what Dean does as far as bringing in the right personnel.
Do you think that perhaps the talk around Jack Grealish joining one of the traditional top six clubs has cooled a little bit over the last little while? Obviously, there was controversy surrounding Grealish over lockdown, a couple of antics breaking, lockdown procedures and all that sort of thing. Do you think that cools the jets a little bit if you're Manchester United or Tottenham?
No, I don't really, because I think, you know, okay, there was a few transgressions from that point of view, but overall, I think he has grown up a little bit in many respects. That might be against what's happened, you know, when he's coming out or doing what he did through lockdown. But as a player, he's grown. You know, on the pitch, he's grown, certainly. He's taking a lot more responsibility. He's doing a lot more in possession of the ball. And it's, I think one of the things is, who's got the money? I mean, it's quite easy to say to move on, but I don't know how much, you know, clubs like Chelsea, well, if they're going to be looking at someone like Jack Grealish, Manchester United, I know Man United have got the money, but the others, you know, I'm not so sure at the moment with the environment we're in. There's a lot of clubs that are struggling because obviously the finances isn't quite there. I'll give you an example. We Tottenham normally bring in 5 million every home game. They haven't got that. There's no one coming to the game. So, you know, that's money they haven't got, and they have to be self-sufficient. So I don't know how much money the likes of a Tottenham, for example, will have, or an Arsenal, if they're the sort of clubs they might be looking at Jack Grealish. So we'll have to wait and see, you know, what the priorities are for the clubs and the sort of players that they're looking at.
It's a really good point, and that self-sufficiency is a point I wanted to touch on in the context of Liverpool, Ray, because obviously they got to 99 points, an incredible tally yesterday afternoon, and the possibility of now dominating, of at least starting with back-to-back titles, is going to be one of the big themes in the off-season. Because of that self-sufficiency, because of the fact that perhaps the transfer market won't explode as it usually did in previous summers, are Liverpool now really well-placed to actually back this up and do back-to-back titles?
Yeah, I think they are well placed, but I think there will be obviously some opposition from the likes of Manchester United, who had a good end to the season. Chelsea, who have already, you know, they've already gone out there, haven't they, with the likes of Zajic and a couple of others who they've got out and bought Werner as well. So I think they have been doing good business behind the scenes, Chelsea. I think they have to look at the defence and goalkeeper, though. I think that is a weakness because the consistency from that area of the field isn't quite there. I think Manchester United will be there or thereabouts. I think they will add in as well. I think there's funds there for them to go and spend. Man City, they need to spend. Liverpool, they've actually got some very good youngsters coming through. So they need to go out and spend big on you know, players from outside the club at the moment. Might not be as relevant because they have got, the good squad and the strong squad there. And it's amazing, isn't it? We've had, well, Man City 2-3 seasons ago, 100 points. Liverpool 99 last season. Man City 98, Liverpool 97. So there is a dominance there, isn't there? And if you look at, I think someone was pointing out to me, I mean, Manchester United were nearer relegation. They were 32 points ahead of the likes of Bournemouth, and they were 33 points away from Liverpool. So it's a massive gap, isn't it, when you look at it that way?
It really is. Do you put that down to the fact that the likes of Manchester City and Liverpool are taking the Premier League to a height we've never seen before? Or do you think it's to do with the middle third and the bottom third really falling away in recent years?
Well, I think there's a bit of that. I think a bit of both, to be honest. I mean, Liverpool, 32 wins this season. They had, 30 last season. I mean, that's an incredible achievement, isn't it? And Man City, you know, had two seasons like that as well, didn't they? Where they had 100 points in the following season. Last season they had 98, you know, so it just shows you that, you know, with certain clubs, when they get on a run, they're very difficult to play against, and virtually teams are beaten before they've even kicked a ball. But there's a middle ground at the moment, and I think because of the riches in the Premier League, it's all about survival. You know, as long as you don't finish in 18th, 19th and 20th spot for the likes of teams like Sheffield United, you know, and teams like that, Burnley, West Ham, they're happy enough to survive. I mean, I was at Crystal Palace yesterday. They've got no funds there, so it's of paramount importance that they stay in the division to get some money in, maybe just to bring in one or two new faces. But you know already which teams are going to struggle for next season and the ones that are going to be competing for the top spots.
For sure. Having now seen Liverpool achieve the 99 points, the second greatest total in the history of the Premier League in a single season, where do they now rank, having seen the 38 games overall, in terms of the great Premier League winners?
Well, I mean, they've been first class. I mean, the problem they're going to have is because of the pandemic and the fact that the season was so fragmented. You know, it's been going on forever, hasn't it? I mean, I was at Crystal Palace yesterday, and we're making the joke about, you know, Liverpool was in the Champions League final 13 months ago. I mean, and we're still going in the league. I mean, that's how mad this season has been. But it'll be memorable, maybe not for the right reasons, but for the Liverpool supporters, they've had to put up with ridicule, if you like, for 30 years, not winning the Premier League and not winning the title in that space of time. They'll just be delighted and happy that they've finally won it. And at the moment, they are current Premier League champions, current European champions and current World Club champions. I mean, that's a remarkable turn of events, if you like, since Jurgen Klopp's come in. The finals he's got them to and the trophies that they've won.
For sure. And I think even the pandemic, Ray, probably makes it an even more memorable season. Like, we're certainly not going to forget the way they've done it in a hurry. Listen, Ray, good chatting to you. Thanks a million for taking the call.
Yeah, thank you.
Ray Houghton there on the line. We'll be talking to another former Aston Villa player in Paul Merson in just a moment here on OTBAM. But just a reminder that if you missed anything from the show this morning, you can catch the podcast back after 10 o'clock over on the OTB Sports app. You'll get our Gillette Pressure Rankings, Football with Daniel Harris and Ray Houghton, GAA with Kieran Donaghy, and the latest sports pages too. You can search for OTB Sports in the App Store and download. As I said, we will be getting Paul Merson on in just a moment. Let's tell you what is on otbsports.com this morning. We have got the OTBAM article, which is live. We've got Brian Kerr on the positions Man United need to address for next season. And Everton's Leighton Baines announces his retirement from football. Roy Keane, then, if you missed this yesterday, he wasn't overly impressed with Aston Villa's survival celebrations, and a lot of pain is a direct quote from Eddie Howe. Emotional Howe reflects on Bournemouth relegation. So that is how things are looking on otbsports.com. Those Roy Keane comments, interesting enough, we'll get Paul Merson's take on that in just a moment. And he is with us now. Paul, how are you getting on?
Good, thank you.
So let's start with that, the thing that I've just mentioned there. Roy Keane, not overly impressed with Aston Villa celebrations, but I'm sure you'll forgive them for a pretty big night last night after surviving by the skin of their teeth.
Yeah, I can understand Roy Keane. Obviously, he's a serial winner. He's won everything in the game. He's never really been in that position. But they've underachieved Villa, of course, there with the amount of money they spent. But to stay up at the same time, you've got to celebrate that. You've got to. I mean, let's be honest. They're not going to win the Premier League, are they? You know, they're a team that, if they stay up, it's a job done. And that's what they've done. And they celebrate that like Liverpool winning the league. It's exactly the same for Aston Villa. You know, they just come up from another league, from the Championship. You know, spent a lot of money, but didn't spend the money wisely. And, you know, their aim is to stay in the league. And, you know, why not celebrate?
Absolutely. How much, given the fact that you just mentioned there that they perhaps got financially out-muscled at times over the last little while, how much of this is down to Dean Smith and what he has managed to do in terms of galvanising this group since football has resumed?
Well, I'm a big fan of Dean Smith. I thought he was outstanding at Brentford also. And I'm a big fan of his. And I think the break sort of helped him a little bit. I think if we didn't have lockdown, I think they would have just fizzled out. They'd just been beaten by Leicester 4-0, ripped apart, and they probably would have just continued and got relegated. But with the break, it helped them, and fair play to put in the performances they did. They rode their luck with the Sheffield United goal, but you know, the last four results are absolutely phenomenal. But it's all about timing. You know, you look at the fixtures and you think, oh, these are hard fixtures. You know, Villa need to get their points early doors. But you go to Everton, who have got nothing to play for, who are struggling. You play Crystal Palace, who are on a bad run, who were safe, had nothing to play for. You play Arsenal, who just had a massive FA Cup semi-final win against Man City that took a lot out of them. And then you look at it and you're thinking, core, the West Ham game could be a winner-takes-all. And West Ham had done their job, and it was, you know, it was a testimonial football match.
Yeah, it's been an incredible couple of weeks for them, really. How do you see the spending going then this summer? Because Ray Houghton was just saying that perhaps Aston Villa are better set financially than a lot of teams that might have been in a similar situation in the past. It's going to be all about Jack Grealish, no matter or not he stays put. But beyond that, is it a situation where if he goes, they then sign? Or they probably need to add assets on top of Jack Grealish where he to stay too?
Yeah, I mean, my first aim would be to sit down and try and get Jack Grealish to stay. I mean, he's a massive Villa fan. I think he ticks the boxes to stay. There's a lot of boxes to be ticked where he's going to play every week, you know, at Aston Villa. You know, it don't matter how bad he plays. At Aston Villa, he'll touch the ball at least 70 to 100 times a game. You know, you go somewhere else, a big club. One, he's not assured of playing every week. It's not like the old days you get bought and you're going to play every week. One, he might not play every week. And two, he'll have to change his game. And he might touch the ball 30, 40, 50 times in a game instead of 100. So he's got to weigh that up. And I was fortunate enough to play at Aston Villa. It's a massive football club. Ray Houghton will tell you the same. But you're not going to win much at Aston Villa. That's the problem. But that's my main aim if I was a Villa man, if in charge at Villa, is to keep Jack Grealish.
Yeah, it's sad.
And if they don't and they start getting 70, 80 million, don't go and buy 12 players for five million quid each. Go and buy a £50 million player if you can. You know, I hate when teams do that. You know, they sell someone for 70-odd million and then they buy eight players for about six million each. I mean, that don't even add up to one player. So for me, if they do sell him, replace him with another superstar or another hero, I would say.
Paul, we should talk about Arsenal as well and what they might need to do over the next little while. Obviously, this Saturday could be a huge moment in their season as well, even for the mood around the club going into next season. But if you kind of want to read into what happened yesterday, David Luiz has now given away 5 penalties in the Premier League this season, which is the most any player has ever conceded in a single campaign in the competition. Is that immediately where you're looking at if you were writing the checks at Arsenal Football Club, that a central defender is an unbelievably high priority?
It is. You know, it tells you everything about Arsenal. When you have to play 3 at the back, that means your centre halves are not that good. You know, David Luiz is black or white. There's no grey areas. He's either a 9 out of 10 or he's a 4 out of 10. You know, he's not going to give you a 7 out of 10 for 10 games on the trot. He's just not going to do it. But he might give you 4 games of 8 or 9 on the trot, but then he could easily give you 3 games on the trot of 4 out of 10. I don't think he's the major problem. I think, you know, they need centre-halves. And as I say, when you're playing 3 at the back, you go through all the teams in the country that play at 3 at the back, that means they haven't got good enough defenders, or the manager doesn't trust the defenders, and that's why you have to play 3 at the back. So Arsenal would have to definitely buy a centre-half. You know, they're looking at Stones. You hear they're looking at Stones. I mean, he's another one. You know, on their day, top draw, but got another 5 out of 10 in his bag every now and then. Which is, you know, when you're playing at top clubs like Man City and Arsenal, you can't afford that.
How do you think Chelsea managed to win the league with 3 at the back a few years ago? Was that probably when the Premier League and its title challenging was at its weakest? Or
I'm not saying you can't win the league. Hmm. No way. I never said you can't win the league. You know, Conte is a top manager, a clever manager. He watched Chelsea get ripped to shreds by Arsenal at the Emirates. And he looked at that game and he went, wow, we ain't good enough at the back, so I will have to play 3 at the back. They played 3 at the back and they went on and won the league. Now, that's great management. I'm not saying you can't win the league with 3 at the back. No, of course you can. But good managers like Conte, he see the problem at Chelsea, played 3 at the back and won the league. And David Luiz was outstanding. And he was outstanding. And he can be on his day. You know, I said Arsenal should sign him up again. You know, because, you know, you don't play for Brazil. You don't win everything in the game if you can't play. Believe me.
How do you rate Mikel Arteta overall as a success story so far at Arsenal? Things have there has been an upturn unquestionably over the past few months. But again, it's going to come back to this idea about not only does he have the backing of the board, which he says he does this summer, but actually how much are the board going to put the money where their mouth is?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to put your money where your mouth is in this day and age. And I say that because Liverpool and Man City are so far ahead. I mean, if the ball went to Arteta now, he owes 200 million, that still could not assure you of Champions League football next season. And that's a lot of money, 200 million. And this is the problem we have now. You know, 200 million 4 or 5 years ago, because teams were quite level, there was a lot of level teams, would probably assure you of top four football. But if it's hard to go and spend 200 million, then all of a sudden Arsenal come sixth or seventh, which it wouldn't shock you with 200 million. So I like Arteta. I think he's outstanding. I think for the first time over the last month or so, I've watched Arsenal and thought, you know what, I know what they're doing here. I know what they're doing. They've got a plan. They're closing down together. They're playing at a high tempo. And you can see what Arteta's trying to do, and I like that. I like that. But is that going to give you top four football next season? It's going to be difficult. You know, Chelsea have bought unbelievably well so far. They probably need another centre-half and a left-back. And then they're massive challengers. I think if Man United could probably go and get Harry Kane if they went and put the boat out for 120 million or something, I think they become massive players as well. So next season's going to be really, really, really good because you look at it, Man City can't be worse than what they were this season, surely not. And Liverpool are just consistently good. So for me, next season's going to be massive.
Sticking with North London then for next season, would you rather be a Tottenham fan or an Arsenal fan next season?
That's a hard one. You're asking someone who played 14 years at Arsenal, who was at Arsenal for 14 years. So that's not a fair question. But if you was asking me as a neutral, I would probably say Tottenham would finish above Arsenal at the moment. I only say that because of the Aubameyang situation. And Mourinho, I still think, one of the best managers in the world of football. I just think Tottenham have got to buy into the way he plays. But as I say, you know, in this day and age, Tottenham building a massive stadium, no fans allowed in at the moment. If Man United come in with an outrageous bid for Harry Kane as the best forward in the league, I don't see how they keep him. I just don't see how they keep him.
It could all change.
You know what I mean? You know, Aubameyang hasn't signed yet. You know, someone, everybody wants centre forwards. You know, and it doesn't matter how players are now. You know, 31, 32. You know, managers are buying players now for now. They're not buying them for in 4 or 5 years' time because, let's be honest, these managers are not going to be at that club in 4 or 5 years' time. So they buy for the now, not for the future.
It's very true. Listen, Paul, thanks a million for taking the call this morning. Really appreciate
Pleasure.
Your time.
Pleasure. Anytime. Not a problem. Anytime.
Great. Great stuff.
Everybody
Cheers, Paul.
Stay well. Bye-bye.
Bye. Yeah, you too. Thanks, Paul. Paul Merson there, formerly of Aston Villa and Arsenal, of course. And that is it from OTB AM this morning. Coming up on OTB Sports Radio today from 1 o'clock, we've got OTB Goals, Brian O'Driscoll in conversation with Eason Asewa. At 3 o'clock then, Paul Rouse and A History of Sport, Episode 2. Then at 4 o'clock, Episode 1 of the OTB Culture Hall of Fame, which is with Andy Lee. At 6 o'clock then, OTB Goals again. And we've got Michael Owen in conversation with Joe on life after football. And then as ever, from 7 o'clock tonight on the radio, but also on the OTB Sports app, it is OTB Tonight with Newsround, Football Show, and all the other good stuff as well. Plenty of reaction to the final weekend in the Premier League. You'll get all of that good stuff on the OTB Sports app. Search for OTB Sports and download for free right now on the Play Store or on the App Store. We'll see you tomorrow morning on OTB AM. We're live as ever from 7:30. Bye-bye for now.
OTB AM.
With Gillette, we don't just play the game, we change it. Gillette, made of what matters. That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.